Hello. Hello, Writers Week. Welcome to another fabulous day here at the Adelaide Writers Week. More fabulous weather, more fabulous authors. Before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge that we gather here today on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and that sovereignty was never ceded. We pay respects to their elders, past, present and emerging, and to their ongoing spiritual and cultural relationship with their country. I'm Tori Shepherd. I'm a journalist at Guardian Australia, and I'm sure you all know who I'm talking to today. I'm talking to Sarah Watling, author and journalist. She won the Lothian Prize, which I looked for, the Tony Lothian Prize, which I looked up and sounds very prestigious, prize for her first book, Noble Savages, and she's here today to talk about tomorrow, perhaps the future, following writers and rebels in the Spanish Civil War. It's an epic book with this marvellous cast of characters. It is just packed full of colour and insight, and I'm really looking forward to hearing some more about it today. Sarah, could you start us off? I'm sure there is no one like this here, but just in case nobody really knows anything about the Spanish Civil War, could you give us a little pressy?
Of course, yeah. It's okay to not know anything about the Spanish Civil War. I didn't know very much about it before I wrote this book. The best way to understand the Spanish Civil War is probably as a failed military coup. It erupted in the summer of 1936 when a group of military generals, who included Francisco Franco, who eventually emerged as their leader, attempted to overthrow the recently elected democratic government of Spain. The regular army was sort of split roughly 50-50. So although the nationalists, as they were called, were able to make big gains across the country, they weren't able to topple the government in the way that they hoped to, partly because there was this kind of upsurge of popular resistance. But equally, the government wasn't able to stamp out this rebellion because it was sort of strong enough that they weren't able to sort of outright defeat them. And then the nationalists very quickly gained a lot of material support from Hitler and Mussolini in Germany and Italy. So at that point, it had sort of accelerated into an all-out civil war.
I was saying to Sarah before that once upon a time, we had this sort of blokey prime minister called Tony Abbott, who, when talking about wars, said, oh, it's not always baddies versus baddies, you know, which is weirdly simplistic but also somewhat true. But the Spanish Civil War is a little more baddies versus goodies.
I think that really gets at one of the things that really interested me about the war and made me think that maybe I wanted to write about it, because I had been interested in it for such a long time, and I had first learned about it as a student, and I really think in some ways that the Spanish Civil War is a young person's cause. You know, when you read about people's recollections of the war, you know, it's often called the last great cause. You know, it's often the cause that people remember as the last time that they were really kind of fueled by ideology or a kind of idealistic moment. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking how incredibly romantic the Spanish Civil War seemed when I first learnt about it.
Apart from the how many dead?
Well, exactly. I mean, I'm getting to that.
Sorry.
Don't worry. I did mature eventually. But it seemed, because to me, obviously, it was sort of unutterably tragic. And, you know, as a teenager, I was very drawn to tragic things. And also, it seemed very simple and clear-cut to me. You know, it was, as you say, there were goodies and there were baddies. There were the nationalists and there were the people who were fighting for a Spanish democracy. And then when I came back to the subject as, you know, someone with a bit more experience in history and a bit older, and I was kind of sceptical about this idea that war could ever be that simple. And I was also very suspicious about the idea of romanticising such a terrible event in history. And I really wanted to kind of dig into that. And as I began to do that, I realised that the war had been simple for a lot of people, or that people had managed to make it simple. And I was very intrigued by this idea that in some way we need things that are incredibly complex and difficult and challenging to be simple in order to easily sort of know where we stand. And so I wanted to kind of look at that idea of, you know, what happens when we try and make things simple? You know, are there benefits to that? Are there dangers? What were these people doing there? You know, what did they need from the war?
I'm going to get you to do a little intro to some of the characters, and then I think I'll get you to do a short reading from your book, if that's okay?
Sure.
Great. So you write in the book, what's unusual about the Spanish Civil War is how much it mattered to people who had nothing to do with Spain. So as with all great non-fiction, what Sarah's done is taken history and used it as a hook for universal human themes to explore various facets of bravery and solidarity, and gender to one extent. She writes about writers, photographers, journalists who headed over to Spain, many of them very well-known names. Sarah, so who was your favourite? Is that a bit like the favourite child question? It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure if I had children, I'd be able to pick a favourite very easily. But when it's people you've written about, it's completely different. I mean, one of my kind of secret favourites is Josephine Herbst, because she was so rude. She was so good at being appallingly rude to and about people. And I just admire that as a quality. But I also think that she was somebody who was always kind of a little bit suspicious, and she was always up for a fight. You know, she was a real scrapper. Like, she was someone who'd always struggled. And so that made her quite difficult to co-opt into a movement. So she was somebody who was really... And she is also somebody who was... had been very well known and is now almost entirely forgotten. So I really enjoyed following her, but I obviously love them all equally.
All right, do you want to do us a little reading, and then we'll meet some more people from your book?
Sure. So I'll just read a very short section from an early part of the book, which is when Sylvia Townsend Warner and her partner Valentine Ackland, who are two communist writers, arrive in Barcelona in 1936. And this is the kind of moment in the Spanish Civil War that was made famous by Orwell. This is the moment where, you know, Barcelona was somewhere where the workers had kind of spontaneously risen up to defy the nationalist attempt at overtaking the government, and they had managed to defeat them. So this was a real kind of hotspot of workers' power, and it sort of unleashed a social revolution in Barcelona in the early part of the war. And so people like Sylvia Townsend Warner, who was already a communist, were arriving in this moment, and they really felt like this, you know, was a real moment of possibility, that out of the carnage of this war, there may even be a chance to kind of build an entirely new type of society. And what I was very fortunate in with her work was that I also had access to her papers, which are held in an archive in the UK. And I had assumed that I would just be working from her published work, because she wrote a lot of what she described as propaganda for the American press about the war. But I also discovered letters that she and Valentine had written to each other from Spain, and also love poems that she'd written for Valentine while she was in Barcelona. And it really made me realise, you know, it's not that she wasn't conscious of how awful the things that were happening in Spain were, or how important they were. And writing, you know, and writing love poems was not her way of trivialising that, but it was, to me, it made it very clear to me how politics never only happens on a public level, right? It's operating in people's personal lives as well. And Sylvia and Valentine lived, you know, one of the poems she writes about arriving in Spain, and she says, "No longer was our own freedom an exile." And they were, as a queer couple, they were used to being in some ways in exile in their own home. And for some reason in Barcelona, because of this moment of change and possibility, they felt kind of accepted. They felt like they belonged in a new way. So that, to me, was kind of beautiful. So that's a very long context for this.
Can I also just say how exciting to find unpublished work like that as a journalist and a historian and an author.
It's extraordinary. What, and it's moment. In this, like, really, it was obviously a gift. So it's in this gorgeous little kind of booklet that she had bound for her lover. I mean, it's really lovely. And there's something about people's handwriting as well that really brings them alive. But so I'll just read a tiny bit about these poems. For love poems about war, those in the booklet are largely, some might say inappropriately, unmarked by loss. Everything is expansion. Revelation. Sylvia and Valentine love the people they meet. They love the cause. They are so bound to it that they share its pulse and hold so close to one another that its beating comforts Sylvia through her lover's body when she imagines fascist bombers speeding on their way. And then I quote, "Embraced with all my power of love, not only you I clasp, not only you I greet." In a puckish account of their palatial accommodation in the fourth poem of the booklet 6, Sylvia revels in the idea that their presence has been directly enabled by the driving out of the old world, taking transgressive pleasure in imagining the pious enemies whose marital bed they have usurped. But in that bed with lean bodies and laughing minds we lay. This, perhaps, was their reward, or a promise of greater rewards to come with victory. For living as they did was already their gift for the future, their legacy to others who might yet live their freedom. I love you with the arrogance of first love, that knows no one in the world loved just so, or so completely, ever before, Valentine told Sylvia when she thought she might have to go to Spain alone. But I hope very many people will after us, sweetheart, and we've done our best to make it possible.
That was absolutely beautiful, and certainly not what you expect to read in books about war. Now, I'm going to use your book as a little prop here. You probably can't see this, but hopefully you've had a look at it. So the subtitle, Writers, Rebels and the Spanish Civil War. I heard you yesterday say that you demanded your publishers take the word women out of the subtitle. Talk us through that.
Yes, I was very assertive in that moment. It's my big upsurge of courage with my publishers. We had a question about whether to say this was a book about, you know, to have women in the subtitle, as you say. And I was kind of perplexed by the question because I thought that it's not a book about women. It's a book about solidarity and the arts and politics and the 1930s and all these things. And it just happens to include a lot of female characters. And I sort of quite firmly believe that women's lives can be used to answer all of the big questions that we have about history. You know, they were there alongside the men. They were as motivated and as mobilized by the same issues. They were just as interested. They were just as smart. And we can write about women without writing about their lives as women. And I have to say, it was very interesting to me when the book was published that so many people nevertheless described it as a book about women, or that it was so kind of evident to people that the male figures who we usually hear about in this history have been kind of marginalized in this book in the way that people
aren't
used to. I know, it was very sad. I mean, I felt terrible about it. but yes, and I think, you know, the women in this book, they thought that their work was interesting and they didn't see gender as the most interesting thing about them or their achievements. That was an interesting thing to explore.
Indeed. We have a great Australian historian, Claire Wright, who often says she's just putting them back in because they got taken out.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, you could read about the Spanish Civil War and not know that so many of these women have been there. But when you look, you can find them. It's not like the information isn't there.
Was it weird for you? Sorry, this is a question without notice. Was it weird for you hearing about Anna Funda's book, Wifehood, the parallels?
When it came out?
Yeah, like was there a moment when you first went, oh, putting women back in the Spanish Civil War, eh? Great idea.
No, it's great. I mean, so, you know, it's kind of reassuring because, you know, obviously I've been working on this book for years and I was really curious about the 1930s, and I think I was interested in it because I could feel sort of parallels, you know, with what I was seeing in the world that I was living through. And a lot of the questions that I had, I felt that were questions that these women had grappled with as well. But, you know, I feel like often writing a book, you're just starting with a load of questions and you're writing almost in a way to say, is anybody else thinking this? Like, did anybody else wonder about this? Like, am I alone in this? So then when other people have books coming out and you realise, okay, this is, you know, yeah, it's not just me going crazy. Like, you know, people are, I think it's interesting. I think certain generations turn to particular moments in history. I think there are kind of cycles in history where, you know, maybe the 1930s, it was interesting to me that a lot of the biographers of these women had started work in sort of like the late 1960s. And there was something about their moment that made them turn back to a previous generation that had been kind of politically disillusioned. Mm. And I think there's maybe something about our generation that is looking back to the 1930s to work out how people lived with the terror of the things they could see on the horizon, you know.
We might come back to that, I reckon. Look, while I've got my prop here, again, there is this amazing photograph on the cover here, and it's a militia woman. I'm not sure she'd still be called that today. She's wearing cute little kitten heels, overalls, and she's she's wielding a pistol quite threateningly. And there's a whole story behind this photo, isn't there?
Yeah, this was an example of when me and my publisher were 100% aligned and we all agreed, so that was good. But I really, really love this photo. This photo was taken by Gerda Taro, who's one of the characters in the book, who was a German, well, she'd been raised in Germany. She actually had a Polish passport, but a Jewish photographer who was living in exile from Germany by this point and who went to Spain with her partner, Robert Capa. And one of the kind of most revolutionary and shocking to the outside world elements of what was happening in Barcelona was that women had been mobilised to fight in the militias. And Gerda went to the beaches outside of Barcelona and took photos of them training. And on the one hand, I think it's a very beautiful photo. First of all, it shows her skill as a photographer, but it also shows her sort of canny professional sense of exactly what's newsworthy about this moment. Mm. But to me, it also kind of shows a woman I think there must have been something so exciting to her about this image. And I can imagine her looking at this and it resonating with her, because this is a woman in a totally new role. You know, she's doing something that women have never been expected to do. And this is exactly what Gerda Taro is attempting as, you know, a war photographer in a world, in a man's world, essentially. So I think there's just a lovely kind of confluence of interests and meaning for this picture.
And is it fair to say that Gerda didn't always get the recognition that she deserved?
I mean, I imagine that Robert Capa is a very familiar name for people, and possibly more familiar than Gerda Taro's. And I mean, neither of those are their real names. And in fact, Robert Capa was a name that was invented by Gerda to sort of help launch her partner's career. And obviously, he became a very famous war correspondent. What's interesting to me is, you know, one of the themes for this book, one of the things I was interested in is, you know, how historical narratives get written in the first place, and how they get kind of shored up over time and what falls by the wayside. And it became evident that, you know, the prejudices and the disadvantages that are operating within our lifetimes persist after death in the ways that we're memorialized or forgotten. And Gerda had a number of disadvantages from that point of view, particularly, you know, she died very young. She was killed during the war. She came from a Jewish family, so her entire family was wiped out in the Holocaust. So there was almost no documentary evidence. There were no kind of keepers of her flame, so to speak. And that meant that it was very easy for researchers to make, and she and Capa were often working very closely together in Spain. So they often have quite similar photographs or photographs of the same scene. So when it came to attributing those photographs, it was very easy for sexist assumptions, essentially, about her capacities to kind of hold sway. And a lot of her images ended up being attributed to Capa that had actually been taken by Taro. And that was, it was only in the, I think in about 2007, when a huge cache of her negatives were discovered, that it was possible to prove that actually, you know, a lot of these extraordinary and iconic pictures were taken by Gerda.
Mm. Wow. Now, I'm very much looking forward to talking about Nancy Cunard. But before we get to Nancy, could you maybe give us just a little overview of some of the other characters? I think people here would definitely know Martha Gellhorn. And there are a couple of others that they might not know so well.
Yeah, so the Spanish War really catches Martha Gellhorn at a really interesting moment because, you know, I think these days she's probably best known as a very brilliant war correspondent and also as one of the wives of Ernest Hemingway. And Spain kind of catches her at the beginning of both of those moments. It's just as her affair with Hemingway is launching, or I mean, Spain is where that kind of takes off. And it's also her first experience of reporting from a war. And what's really interesting about her work from Spain, I think, is that you can see her kind of searching for a mode that's appropriate to what she's seeing and what she wants to convey to audiences at home. And then, as I mentioned, there's Josephine Herbst, who was kind of steeped in the American radical movement, who came to Spain with really high hopes of kind of finding a sort of validation for this kind of slightly nebulous idea of the possibility of international solidarity and workers' rights and, you know, radical change, and really hoping to find that confirmed in Spain. Mm-hmm. And then there's Sylvia Townsend Warner, who I mentioned, who's really a novelist, but who comes to Spain hoping to explicitly to write propaganda. And it's very interesting to see how well she tailors what she writes about to different audiences. There's Langston Hughes.
You can go as long as you like. Yeah. I think it's the most fascinating group of people.
Session. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of them. And I kind of, you know, there's so much serendipity in how people sort of emerge in your research and announce that they want to be in your book. But I think each of them kind of enabled me to follow a different question. So Langston Hughes, for example, is somebody who was very used to his work. You know, he in some ways was seen to represent a certain community, you know, as an African-American. And he was used to these kind of competing demands on his work that people, you know, certain sections of his community thought he should represent, you know, a certain image, or, you know, his white publishers thought that he expected him to write in a certain way that wasn't true to his rights. So he was used to kind of fighting for his own sort of true vision of what his work was and what it should do. And so it was very interesting for me to follow him into a scenario where it was understood, it was just sort of accepted that art should be political and that it should be kind of harnessed to the cause, mm-hmm. and to see him try and sort of negotiate that tension.
On to Nancy then. So Nancy Cunard, I knew nothing about, I've got to say, before reading your book. Can you paint us just a colour picture of what sort of person she was?
I can try. I mean, she's an extraordinary person and not an uncomplicated person. I mean, I think she is somebody who really taught me that, you know, maybe an essential part of being a good ally is humility, and that was something that she was kind of really lacking in. But it also was something that kind of enabled her to take bold stands in her life. Hers, you know, in a sad way, it's almost a kind of reverse Cinderella story. She was born into great wealth and privilege. Her mother was one of the kind of great London hostesses, so she grew up kind of surrounded by the greatest writers and artists and politicians of her day. And she was a kind of British it girl at a moment when the gossip columnists were really kind of starting to grow their audience. And she kind of rebelled against all of that. She moved to Paris after the First World War, which was a very kind of traumatizing experience for her and her whole generation. She became very involved in, you know, all of the kind of avant-garde movements of Paris. She was the partner of Louis Aragon for a long time. And she's kind of remembered as a muse, you know, and a kind of a fashion icon. But she was also a poet. She published collections of poetry with Virginia Woolf's Hogarth Press. She was also a publisher herself, and she was arguably the person who discovered Samuel Beckett. And she then kind of got into journalism and used that to campaign for anti-racism and anti-imperialism and all these things. So she was somebody who was used to being in the public eye, who was really trying to harness that attention for her own ends. But she really alienated the people that she came from with a lot of these campaigns. And most famously, she had a long affair with a black jazz musician, and she wrote publicly about the treatment that they experienced when they went to London, and specifically about her mother's racism and her mother's opposition to this relationship in a way that her peers thought was really unforgivable. You know, like, if it was, you know, maybe it was fine if your mother was a racist, frankly, but also, you know, you shouldn't criticize your mother in public, especially when she's kind of famous and important. So she had burned a lot of bridges, but she was, incredibly passionate, and she wasn't the kind of person who ever kind of hesitated or, you know, overthought things. So when she heard about the Spanish War breaking out, she was very suspicious about the kind of stories that she was reading in the French press, which she knew was pretty conservative, about the... And some of it, you know, was true. There was a lot of violence in the Republican zone at the beginning of the war. But she felt that this was a very one-sided view, and she knew already that her sympathies lay with the Republic. So she just crossed the border and went to Spain and decided to start reporting. And she then made a number of like long trips to Spain, and she just kind of roamed the country. She learned Catalan, she already spoke Spanish, and she just, you know, she was somebody who, despite her background, was really good at building up a rapport with people from all different kinds of backgrounds. So she just spoke to people and got all the information she could. And as I think we'll probably come to, I mean, she was a big campaigner, and she was very good at kind of drawing awareness to things like this.
I heard you say at one point she wanted to be asked about her campaigning and her activism and all these issues that she was very passionate about, but she was more often asked about the hat she was wearing.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so this is from Nancy. It's a rallying cry. It's clear to many of us throughout the whole world that now, as certainly never before, we are determined or compelled to take sides. The equivocal attitude, the ivory tower, the paradoxical, the ironic detachment will no longer do. They're strong words.
Strong words.
What happened with these words and the petition that Cunard put out?
So that's taken from a questionnaire that she sent out in 1937, so this was about a year into the war. And she sent it to about 200 writers whose addresses that she could find in Britain and Ireland. And as you said, you know, asking them to just state very simply, she asked them to write 6 lines, but because they were writers, they all wrote much more than that. Asking them just to say whether they were on the Republican side or the Nationalist side in the war. And she said to them, I'm asking you to do this, for it is impossible any longer to take no side. So she obviously felt that with this moment, neutrality was no longer an option. And when she says, you know, the ivory tower, the ironic detachment will no longer do, she's really tapping into a live debate at that moment in the 1930s about what what the arts were for and what the responsibility of an artist was. And you can see that in the responses that these writers are sending back, they are also debating this amongst themselves. They're trying to work out what their place in the world is. And it's so interesting to see how they sort of interpret the question differently. But one of the kind of central things, and this idea of the ivory tower, is this idea that a writer has, you know, either an ability or a kind of special right to sort of withdraw from the world, you know, that they, as a writer and as somebody who works in their intellect or their imagination, they have some kind of respite, you know, that they can retreat from the kind of crises and debates that kind of animate.
Don't be afraid.
I may duck at any moment. That's a kind of refuge that they can take. And then when you see how some of the writers are responding to Nancy, like Ian Forster, for example, or T.S. Eliot, who says something like, I think it's important for... what is it he says? That it basically says that, you know, some men of letters, as he calls them, should remain uninvolved, that they actually think that it's not necessarily a right of a writer to retreat, but a responsibility, because somebody needs to kind of remain above the fray. And there is something in that argument, because obviously, you know, in this moment, the real danger is coming from totalitarian regimes. And so the idea of a kind of private realm of the intellect that can't be intruded upon is exactly the realm that a totalitarian regime is going to try and invade, right? So there is this idea that being able to preserve that kind of critical distance and that mental independence is kind of crucial to the survival of things like democracy. Whereas Nancy Cunard is saying, you know, your writers, you are inextricably tied to the society around you. You draw your inspiration from it and you owe something back to it. And, you know, you are the people who can make a difference when, you know, human society is imperiled, and it's your responsibility to be clear about what you stand for.
Mm. I was telling Sarah that we've been having similar conversations today in Australian journalism, particularly in light of the current war in the Middle East, and a petition that went around that many people signed has sparked a lot of conversations about partisanship and objectivity and the actual role of the journalists so far without clear answers. How did it turn out for Nancy? Spoiler alert, it didn't all go swimmingly.
No, well, yeah, and this, I mean, in some ways, obviously, you know, the writers that I'm following, they were all hoping for the victory of the Republic, and they were all hoping that their reporting would make a difference and help to ensure the victory of the Republic. So when it was defeated, and as we know, that resulted in a 30-year dictatorship in Spain, it was extraordinarily disillusioning for them, you know, and they had to rethink all the things they had believed about their work. And, you know, for someone like Martha Gellhorn, it was just an appalling kind of loss of faith, because when she first went to Spain, you know, she says something about how she genuinely believed that the reason that people didn't do anything about the terrible things that were happening in the world was because they genuinely didn't know. And so if she could just go to Spain and show people the children being killed in the streets of Madrid, that would be enough, you know, to make a difference. And I think she also felt guilty, because for so many of these people, you know, their experience in Spain was the most vivid and meaningful experience of their lives, and it never left them. And Martha Gellhorn wrote about this kind of sort of perfect symmetry of being in Spain, because it was the one time in her life where she felt that she was writing for a purpose, because, you know, writing was basically what made life bearable and meaningful for her. And if she felt that she could do that and be doing good with it, that was, you know, the best anyone could hope for from life. And when she realized that hadn't had the effect that she hoped for, she could only feel terrible for having gained so much from it, you know? And so for a long time, she always hoped to write a novel about Spain, and she was never able to, because she was so kind of emotionally bound up in it. And I read one letter I read that really moved me, that Josephine Herbst wrote, actually, was in the 1960s, so like sort of 30 years after she'd been in Spain, and she went to the cinema to watch a documentary about Spain. And she said to her friend, she was so glad that she was alone at the cinema, because she just sat by herself and wept through the whole thing. And she said she knew it was because that was the time in her life when she was most alive. And she kind of was reflecting on it afterwards and trying to work out what she had learned, or what could be kind of salvaged from that experience, despite everything that happened afterwards. And, you know, this was a you know, a fellow traveller who had then lived through the McCarthy era. So she'd been through some tough times since Spain. Everything had been very kind of disillusioning. And she said, you know, I think it's so important to continue the harassment, by which she means the harassment of people in power. And she really believed that by just, and Gellhorn believed this as well, but that by at least leaving a record of those people's resistance, that they were doing something meaningful, and that they were leaving a record that future generations of activists and resistors could draw upon. So that, I think, was what they managed to kind of salvage from the experience.
Salvage, indeed. There's something so unbearably tragic about the idea that you believe that if you just show people the injustices that are being carried out in the world, that will save the world and being proven wrong.
Yeah.
Now, you've said this is not a new history of the Spanish Civil War. Can you explain that?
I think there have been many histories written of the Spanish Civil War. And also, I didn't want to say I'm writing a new history of the Spanish Civil War because my book is very much interested in outsiders and how being an outsider sort of complicated the ways that people performed and understood solidarity. So it's not a book that includes many Spanish voices. And obviously, I don't think that you can write a history of the Spanish Civil War and leave out the Spanish experience. So I wanted to be clear about that. But I also felt that this was not so much a retelling as a kind of a recentering, because there are certain voices like Orwell and Hemingway and a number of kind of British poets who happen to go to Cambridge University, who have kind of formed our cultural memory of the Spanish War. And I was so astonished when I started researching it that there were all of these people who had been involved, who I either had never heard of or who I knew quite well but had never realised that they'd been so kind of touched or their thinking had been so formed by this conflict. And I really think that once you, you know, start looking beyond the canon, you have a much richer sense of how broadly this cause resonated internationally and how it came to mean so many different things to so many different people. So I wanted to show that you can that you can write a history addressing all of these questions through the work and voices of people who are less, you know, less familiar to traditional historiography.
And is there something as well, it is an entirely new dimension to look at the outsiders. Why is it, you know, what can you learn through the outsiders in a war like that that maybe you couldn't learn from the people who were enmeshed in it because it was their country?
Well, I mean, this is one of the kind of really rare and extraordinary things about the Spanish War, that it did mobilise so many people from outside the country. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that that tapped into an experience that these people were used to as writers as well, because they all identified in some way or another as outsiders. And it seems like a sort of fundamental part of their sort of professional identities as well, because they saw themselves as onlookers, essentially, that they were always, you know, on the outside looking in, and that's what gave them their perspective on the things that they could write about. And that obviously is something that becomes very complicated when you go into a conflict and you pick a side, you know, because then do you still really count as an outsider, or have you in some way been co-opted? You know, are you still holding to your principles as a writer? And it's one of the interesting things about the war, I think, because a lot of the people going to Spain didn't actually know very much about Spain or about the political situation before the war erupted. And so in a certain way, you know, they could choose any meaning they wanted for this war. You know, it didn't have to be
the Rorschach War.
Sorry.
The Rorschach War. You can see whatever you want.
It didn't have to be a meaning that would necessarily be familiar to Spanish people who actually knew something about what was going on. And in a way, and they were, you know, they were, a lot of them saw going to Spain as a kind of continuation of the struggles that they were used to from home or the campaigns that they were already involved in. And that was kind of extraordinary because it enabled this kind of international solidarity. It enabled people to see these kind of overarching power structures and systems of oppression and how they operated across national borders and how they could be opposed. But it also sometimes meant that, you know, there was a sense in which there was a risk that coming to Spain and writing about what Spanish people were going through, that someone like Martha Gellhorn could be sort of drowning out the very voices that she was trying to amplify, because she maybe was not expressing the understanding that they had of what they were living through.
You can see that kind of unintended consequence, I think, particularly because, as you said, they didn't necessarily know a lot about what was going on. So obviously, there's stated motivations with it idealistically and ideologically. They were aligned with the resistance. That it seems like such an incredibly brave thing to have done, to have sort of packed up and taken yourself off to the middle of a civil war. But was it also a little bit naive, perhaps?
I think in a way it was probably impossible not to be naive, because one of the kind of extraordinary things about what they were seeing in, you know, you have to remember that this is before the Blitz, you know, it's before Hiroshima, it's before the bombing of Dresden, you know, nobody has seen a European capital come under aerial bombardment in the way that, you know, the Luftwaffe were bombing the hell out of a lot of the Spanish cities. And so that was one of the kind of shocking things that people like Martha Gellhorn and Gerda Taro really wanted to convey to the outside world. But it also meant that, yeah, of course, I mean, they weren't prepared. They didn't really know what the kind of danger that they were taking themselves into. But on the whole, they were all quite sort of gung-ho personalities. But I think it's also a sign of how high they understood the stakes were at this point. You know, you have to understand the war in the context of the appeasement policy. And every single one of the people in this book understood the fight for the Republic as a way also to stand up to fascism before things escalated into a much bigger war. So one of the people we haven't talked about is Nan Green, who was a British communist who volunteered as a kind of administrator, actually. She wasn't really a writer, although she did later write a memoir. And she spent more than a year in Spain, and she left behind two small children. Her husband was already fighting with the International Brigade, so she left them at boarding school. I think the eldest was six or something like that. And somebody wrote to her and said, you know, what are you doing? You're abandoning your children. And she said, I'm fighting for my children. I'm fighting to ensure that they can, you know, flourish in a world that isn't marred by war. I want them to grow up in a democracy. You know, they really believed that this was their chance to build the future that they wanted to see. So I think they were naive to a certain point, but I also think they were brave, and they thought that, you know, and a couple like Valentine and Sylvia, as, you know, a queer couple, Valentine said to Sylvia at one point, you know, there's a chance we'll be killed in Spain, but I don't think either of us are going to survive the next few years anyway, because there's either going to be a war or we'll end up in a fascist country that won't let people like us survive. So they really thought the stakes were that high that it was worth the risk, I think.
Was it commonly known at that point that this was the kind of the first tendrils of fascism? I mean, you know, nowadays we know almost too much information about everything that's going on, and we have information and misinformation, but, you know, Would the public in general know the importance of stopping fascism at this point?
Well, it depends what you mean by commonly known. You know, it's a really good point, because, I mean, one of the things that motivates Nancy to go, obviously, is that she feels that the conservative press really dominates what the general public know about things like what's happening in Spain, so that maybe they don't really understand the danger from the rising fascist powers. And certainly there's a real frustration with the appeasement policy and this sense that their governments are kind of throwing away these opportunities to confront the fascists before they become too powerful to stop, essentially. You know, and there are so many, you know, this is after Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, or Abyssinia as it was known then. It's after Hitler has started to try and sort of dismantle the Treaty of Versailles. You know, it's pretty obvious that these powers are a threat to international peace. And this was something that seemed very contemporary to me, actually. This, you know, looking at kind of young people, especially today, and their activism on the climate crisis, you know, there is this real sense that the grown-ups in the room don't really appreciate the urgency in the same way that, you know, the people living it on the ground or watching, you know, sort of politically active people see it. And that puts them in a very particular situation, because once you understand that your government isn't going to do what you think they should do, the question becomes, well, what am I going to do? Mm. And that's why, you know, I don't think we've seen a war before where so many individuals will voluntarily, you know, go and be a part of it, because they realise that actually it's up to them at this point.
You wrote about the queasy nature of the appeasement at that time, which I keep in my head kind of portmanteauing into acquiesment. So just to expand on that, is it? I'm kind of sensing that. Imagine how furious people would have felt seeing their governments not doing their part to stop this.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a difficult one for us. You know, we look back at it now and it seems obvious, because we know that the Second World War happened. But we're also a generation that didn't live through the First World War, you know, so it's hard to appreciate how much and how understandably people hope to avoid another global conflict. But it's also undeniable that in the British government, for example, was full of people who thought that they could happily do business with the fascists, you know, and there are a lot of British business interests in Spain. And so what they wanted really was stability in Spain, and dictatorships are nothing if not stable. So, you know, that I think people just didn't really trust their governments. And obviously there is this kind of looming shadow of Soviet Russia. And I mean, the British government are petrified of a revolution happening in the UK, you know, especially after the First World War. You know, communism was the real kind of bugbear, and I think a lot of people were willing to accept anything that wasn't communism. And post the Second World War, Franco was very canny about kind of positioning himself as a kind of bulwark against communism, and he managed to sort of pretend that his war in Spain had all been about, you know, keeping communism out of Spain, which was nonsense because the Communist Party had always been tiny in Spain. You know, the anarchists were the big political power on the left. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of threads you can unpick from.
There are. I was just thinking, yeah, communists have certainly been used in fear-mongering politics here in Australia as well. I was speaking to a historian when I was listening to you, not during, before, listening to you talk to Anna Funder yesterday, and I was saying, it's just so surprising to me, the idea of women kind of just packing up and heading into a war like that. And this historian, sorry, I didn't catch your name, said, why is that surprising? That was the time. That was when they were doing activism properly. You know, these women were fantastic. And I'd meant it more as a journalist. I just can't imagine, you know, the only real way that you would do it as a Western journalist in general would be with the backing of an organisation. You'd go over there and have a fixer, perhaps security, you'd have training, you'd have this kind of infrastructure around it, which these women didn't have, but they did, to a certain extent, have privilege, which allowed them to do it. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how much, what do I want to say? I mean, all of these people, I think, had consciously built themselves lives that offered them a certain element of freedom, which meant that if they wanted to, they could charge over to Spain. Even someone like Nan Green, who on the surface, you know, with two young children, not very much money, seems like she's not very free. She had this strong political commitment as a communist that enabled her to justify those decisions so that she had that kind of freedom. And obviously someone like Martha Gellhorn has the freedom of her privilege, because she has a kind of safety net and she can just go into Spain and you know, if she doesn't make any money or she can't feed herself or she has to suddenly leave, you know, things are probably going to be okay. And it's noticeable that someone like Langston Hughes, for example, doesn't go to Spain until he has a commission from a newspaper and he has the funds to cover him to be there. But I think it also, it speaks to the kind of people they were, the kind of determination that they had, and also, as we were saying, their sense of how important this moment was. And I think the one thing that really kind of unites all of the women in this book is that they weren't optimists. You know, they were all people who were paying attention to what was going on in the world, and that meant that they were really frightened. You know, they looked onto the horizon and what they saw there really scared them. But that somehow galvanized them, and it made them take action. You know, they didn't allow themselves to be paralyzed by their fear. And that, I think, is actually kind of a rare quality, but something that's really extraordinary and valuable.
We are going to take some questions from the audience shortly. So if you want to make your way here to the microphone, it's just standing up there. Please start that. Do you see any equivalents now? I mean, we spoke about young people campaigning for against climate change. I was thinking, you know, most journalists now, particularly foreign correspondents here, are mostly ABC, our equivalent of the BBC, with a very strict kind of adherence to objectivity. But I was thinking maybe we see it more in the citizen journalists or activists online who are already within the war. Is there anyone who is as gung-ho, as you put it, as the women that you write about in your book now? Or is the age of that past because we have the internet, so we don't need people to go charging into these places?
Well, I mean, I think the internet enables people to do a lot more of what Gerda Tara and Martha Gellhorn were trying to do, is to sort of act as witness and to show people in the outside world what's going on. You know, that you have this sort of people who become journalists thanks to their smartphones, you know, who can film a protest that's happening and get the news out before it gets shut down and that kind of thing. And I think one of the things that's coming around again is this kind of suspicion of the idea of trying to find a journalistic balance on important questions, because that can so easily kind of disintegrate into a kind of drawing of false equivalences in a way which sort of creates the opposite of balance. But as I mean, I think a lot of the questions that they were grappling with have come around for us again, and we clearly haven't found any easy answers to them.
No, indeed. Alrighty, let's take some questions, and just a reminder to be civil and courteous and make it a question, not a statement.
Yes, thank you, Sarah and Tori. I've read Anna Funda's account of George Orwell's wife, Eileen, in the Spanish Civil War. Can I ask, did you come across anything in your own research on Eileen in that conflict? And if so, can you tell us something about it?
I did. So I found Anna's book very interesting, particularly because of the way that it was kind of so tightly focused on that moment in Barcelona. And I mean, actually, the people in my book were probably more likely to be those sort of persecuting Eileen Orwell and her colleagues, because Eileen was with the ILP and a lot of mine were communists. So I didn't really come across her. But I mean, there are a lot of women, actually, who were in those kinds of, you know, to maybe minimise it, sort of administrative roles, who were actually doing a lot to sort of keep the men on the front going and navigating a really terrifying political situation by 1937. Who aren't very well known. There are people like Kate Mangan, who was a British woman who kind of followed her German lover when he decided to volunteer in Spain and ended up saving his, you know, rescuing him when he got injured in the same way that Eileen did for George Orwell. So, yeah, I mean, once you start looking, there's a lot of these women working there behind the scenes, but I didn't really come across Eileen specifically.
I also hadn't realised the involvement of African-Americans as well at some point in the Civil War. So, you know, it's fabulous. I think everything, every thread you pull adds more to that.
Well, that was the first time in history that there was a mixed American battalion. So it was the first time that there hadn't been segregation in an American fighting force. Mm. And that, you know, that's a piece of American history that isn't so well known in America, right? That, you know, so that's a really good example of how the war had all of these different meanings for outsiders.
Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk and for coming. I'm wondering if in your research, did you find any personal records of particular challenges that women would have faced in these situations? You know, things like birth control or, you know, sanitary pads, this sort of thing. Do anyone record about those special issues that women would face?
Not that specifically, but there were obviously particular challenges because of being women in a war zone. I mean, one of the obvious and most kind of difficult for them to talk about, I think, were those kind of sexual risks. And there was a woman who was married to an international brigadier commander who was raped by one of her husband's colleagues. And she sort of wrote about how she kept the secret. You know, she didn't expose him because she felt that that had then become her burden for the cause, you know, that these men were risking their lives and something she could do was to keep that secret on his behalf and not kind of besmirch his name in front of his colleagues. So to me, that kind of showed how fraught and difficult this idea of comradeship was for women in that position, because they are trying to claim as comrades men who don't recognise them as comrades in the same way, you know, or who assume that their contribution should be very different. You know, they should have a kind of consolatory or sexual contribution, whereas the women see themselves as contributing in a very different way. And in order to sort of claim those men as comrades, they actually have to kind of hold them to a lower standard than they would do otherwise, which to me was kind of very sad and very interesting.
Is it also that if you are on the side of good, you mistakenly think that everybody is good that's on your side?
Yeah, and I think there is this sense at which people who consider themselves to be on the right side of history then consider themselves to be sort of above interrogation, you know, and then that gets people into very weird contortions. And then, you know, the question of which side you've picked becomes a lot more fraught. Mm. Because it's not the perfect side that you want it to be. And it shouldn't, you know, if something is that clearly right, you know, it should be able to sustain a little bit of interrogation and debate. And so that was a very interesting question for me to explore as well.
All right, we've maybe got time for a couple more questions. If anybody, that gentleman's walking right past the microphone. If anybody else wants to pop up, go for it, absolutely. I wanted to get back to that idea of objectivity, and I had this quote from Gellhorn saying, "All that objectivity shit," which I love, both because, you know, we in journalism we often see that as the pinnacle of journalism, as something that we should always be aspiring to. And within this spectrum of characters, there are some who were more objectively reporting. There seem to be some who do more like colour and description, and then the real activists. Do you see any difference in the effectiveness of those three different approaches?
It's very interesting. So one person I included who we haven't touched on is Virginia Coles, who was a good friend of Martha Gellhorn's. And she was one of very, very, very few journalists in Spain who reported from both the nationalist zone and the republican zone. And I think that meant that in some ways her reporting was taken more seriously because it was considered to be objective, even though she, on a personal level, was much more sympathetic to the republic. It's known that, for example, people in the foreign ministry in the UK were reading her reporting. And so when she presented evidence, for example, that the Italians were breaking the non-intervention agreement, they paid attention and then questions were raised in Parliament. So she could sort of point to very specific achievements from her reporting. Whereas Martha Gellhorn, you know, she sort of deployed much more kind of literary techniques in her work to try and kind of bring alive the experience of civilians or of soldiers to people reading at home. And that was also a very important, you know, more difficult to quantify, but a very important service in a war where actually, you know, so much came down to a PR battle, essentially, because the Republic so desperately needed to persuade its fellow democracies that it was worth supporting. Actually, the way it was perceived abroad was very important. Mm. But I mean, objectivity was a principle that really came under question in the 1930s because there are so many journalists reporting on the collapses of democracy that they were being forced to report on the closure of the free press. You know, they were having to report on their own, the death of their own profession. It's very difficult to do that objectively. And it's almost a kind of professional failing if you act like that's, you know, a perfectly good thing for society or a neutral thing, you know. So, yeah, and I think that Martha Gellhorn felt that it was not right to ask her to report objectively on the kinds of things that she was seeing because it would be dishonest of her to put aside the human reactions that she had to seeing children killed in the streets. Mm.
Do you see parallels with reporting today where there's that eternal struggle between objectivity and the truth, meaning often a very emotional appeal?
I think it's probably a question that's never going to be sort of entirely put to bed. Yeah, I don't know if I have a
no. That was a
final
hard one.
Answer to that one.
Well, look, we do have time for one more question. And sorry, people keep approaching the microphone.
No,
I'm not sure. Nope, walking past
attention.
It. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I do have a question more about a stylistic choice. So, if we read non-fiction about males, they usually refer to using their surname, but you choose to use first names a lot. And I wonder what the purpose of you doing that was.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've been asked this before, and it sort of made me think about a decision that I'd made that maybe wasn't fully conscious, but I think it's partly a kind of immediacy thing. I mean, I don't know, it does irritate me if I see in a book that a male writer is referred to by his surname and the woman gets the full name because, you know, people can't be expected to know off the bat who she is because she's not as important or whatever. But for me, you know, there's a kind of immediacy thing. And because I was spending so much time with these people and because I really wanted to bring them to life as individuals and their own backgrounds and their own emotional responses to what they were seeing in Spain was such a kind of intrinsic part of the story I was trying to tell that it felt right to use their first names. But it certainly wasn't a kind of, I didn't feel that they were, you know, warranted as much professional respect as, I'm pretty sure I refer to Ernest Hemingway as Ernest in the book as well. So.
Thank you so much. I feel like by the end of your book, I was on first name basis with most of those characters. So thank you so much. Sarah will be signing. Sorry, Ms. Wadling. we'll be signing copies of her book as well. I'm sure you all know where the book sign is, and also buy books. They're all in there. There is absolute surfeit of amazing books in the book tent. So please do head over afterwards. And thank you all for coming. And thank you so much, Sarah, for introducing us to your marvellous cast of characters.
Thank you very much. Thank you.